Support for the Sundance Reel on KPCW comes from the film Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, premiering during the 2018 Sundance Film Festival, a documentary about Sandra Lee's journey through breast cancer, from diagnosis to recovery, and encouraging early detection for all women.
It's 9:06, and welcome to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host today, Linda Jager, one of the KPCW Friday film reviewers, also the community engagement manager for Park City Municipal. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you today?
Good, good. Busy. So let's start with some of the films that you've seen and really kind of had an impact on you.
Well, I'm actually on track. I think I'm going to break a record. I'm hitting about 15 films this year, mostly docs. I'm a big doc fan. So far I've seen opening night. I saw Generation Wealth, caught the Mr. Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, which was amazing. And, you know, I grew up with Mr. Rogers, so it was really nostalgic and very moving. And I caught Believer, the documentary done by Dan Reynolds from Imagine Dragons, and that was amazing as well. Very interesting, and obviously filmed and centered in Utah, so that was really interesting. I caught Studio 54 growing up just outside of New York City in that heyday. It was really fun to kind of get the backstory of that famous spot that I snuck into underage.
Oh, so you got picked to go in?
Not during the heyday. It was I think it was when just on its way out. I did get to check out the space, and it was pretty cool.
But that was what was so hilarious, I thought, about it, was Steve Rubell, who just, you know, it was like, you're in, you're out. Yep. Even if they came together, it was just like, you got to be kidding me.
Definitely. RBG was amazing. And to have her there and chat afterwards, it was just so inspiring, and I was just so impressed with her workouts. I mean, RBG's holding a 30-second plank, and she's 84. I have no excuse not to go to the gym. I did actually catch a short, which actually won a special jury award from Sundance yesterday. It was called For Nona Anna, and it was a 13-minute piece about a transgender girl caring for her ailing grandmother. And, you know, not a lot of dialogue, but just the cinematography, and really brought out the emotion. And I was just so moved watching it. And if there's a chance that anyone can catch it, I definitely suggest doing so. And then just coming up, I'm going to catch Crime and Punishment, which we're talking about today. Also, Futile Gesture, Lizzie. I think that's the only feature I'm seeing, actually.
Oh, so that's to be seen?
Yes. Okay. The King, I'm going to catch the documentary, Eugene Jarecki's documentary about Elvis. Juliet Naked, I'm going to catch. Robin Williams' documentary. And then I'd love to see if I can get into We the Animals, we're going to talk about this morning, and Dark Money. What's been your favorite so far?
The one I saw yesterday, and this, again, was in the Spotlight category, and so that means that it had premiered at other film festivals before coming to Sundance, but the programmer who introduced it, John Nine, said not only was it his favorite movie, but one of the best movies he's seen in years. And I was like, wow. So going into a movie with kind of that, you expect a lot. It was really a fabulous story. And then hearing the story from the filmmaker about how he got the idea for the script was fascinating. And he talked about how a daughter, you know, who had woken up late, and, you know, he was pushing out of the house to catch the bus, and gets out of the house, and he learns on the news that this bus has crashed and lots of fatalities, and only to find out his daughter missed the bus. Yeah. So it talks. Yeah. So that was kind of the setting for this. It was from Israel, so mm-hmm. in Hebrew with subtitles, and just some really interesting camera angles. And, I guess that's really, for me, the essence of film is the story, and I was enraptured by it. I love the docs, too. One of my favorite dramatics, though, was this Chinese film called Dead Pigs.
Oh.
And it I guess, based on kind of a something that happened, but I'm not sure for this reason, but lots of dead pigs were found floating in Chinese rivers. And I think it was maybe as a result of swine flu or perhaps, I mean, something else in this movie. But it's based on this protagonist who is just owns this beauty salon and, you know, gets her workers out every morning doing calisthenics. But, you know, I am so good. You know, we are so strong. We are, you know, it was really funny. And one of her memorable lines was, "There are no ugly women, only lazy ones." So I chuckled, but very tender moments as well, as you see how Chinese farmers, you know, very poor, and when they lose their crop, they lose everything. So it was, I really enjoyed that one as well. Anyway, we're going to bring our first guest in. We've got a great lineup this morning, including from the films of We the Animals. Later on, we'll be talking with the director of Dark Money and also Crime and Punishment, and the final one, A Futile and Stupid Gesture. That coming up on the Sundance Reel. Stay with us.
Programming for KPCW is sponsored in part by Mark Wangsgard and Jim Doilney of Retail at New Park, part of the development team of New Park Town Center and co-owners of the New Park Sun Plaza, location of many Park City community events.
It's 9:13. Good morning. This is the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with Linda Jager. Well, writer-director Jeremiah Zagar uses magical realism, animated sequences, and the dreams of his protagonist in We the Animals. It tells to tell a highly original coming-of-age story. He joins me in the studio, along with the author of the novel on which this film is based, Justin Torres. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Jeremiah, I had heard Sundance Film Festival director John Cooper say, whenever the word animals or monster is in the title, he thinks it's good. So tell us about We the Animals.
Well, I mean, it's not my title. It's Justin's title.
Okay, well, Justin, you want to take
that? Yeah, you tell us about that title.
Well, I guess it's about a family that is, the parents are quite young when they start having kids, and they're not quite domesticated just yet. There's a lot of kind of wild, feral energy within the family, and there's kind of insults that were hurled at my own family growing up, kind of like mutts and things like that. So I was kind of trying to twist that in the title and talk about kind of what's positive about all of that wild, untamed energy.
So you had read the book, and it was like, how did that come to be between the two of you?
I read the book. It was at a bookstore that Justin used to work at in New York called McNally Jackson, actually, which is some kind of serendipity, I think.
Yeah.
It's short. It's like 110 pages, 150?
Let's say 120.
Let's say 120.
Fill it out a little.
And I just read it right there in the bookstore. They have a little cafe, and I read the first page, and I was knocked out. And then I read the whole thing, and it reminded me of my family in a way that you never see depicted. There were a lot of things that were very similar, but there was like a sense of physicality and a sense of touch and a sense of untamed affection that was I felt absent from films, and I really wanted to show on screen, and I really felt like I could and I knew how. And there was a rhythm to the book that was very much reminded me of the rhythm of my filmmaking, and I called Justin, and we met up, and I told him I wanted to make it.
So tell me, I mean, I'd explain what you mean by that, the rhythm of the book and how that translates into the film. Since I haven't seen it,
let Justin talk about the rhythm of the book, and I'll explain to you how that is my film, like my filmmaking.
Yeah, so I guess the book is written in kind of these short episodic chapters, these vignettes, and you kind of get to a heightened moment of climax and then a conclusion every few pages. So it's like it comes kind of hard and fast, I think. And it has a kind of energy of these three young boys and and they're kind of running wild constantly. And I think that that's what you're referencing.
Yeah, and it cuts fast. It moves from moment to moment without without caring if you want to follow it or not. Like, it doesn't, it's not holding your hand. Mm-hmm. It's just taking you places. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we make documentaries, it's very similar aesthetic. You know, it's like because you don't have the ability to create continuity, you create often a staccato rhythm that gives an impressionistic idea of where you're going. Mm-hmm. And that really excited me about the book, that, you know, we were on an emotional journey and a rhythmic journey that wasn't beholden to the nature of continuity, and that excited me. And I thought, all right, like, we can make this. It's a series of moments, a series of images that that will stay with an audience.
And this was your first feature. You, as mentioned before, had done mostly documentaries.
Documentaries are features too.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. film. And what are some other differences in the process?
There's a lot of differences in the process. With a documentary, the biggest difference is with a documentary, you wait. You know, mm-hmm. You wait for the thing to emerge that you're looking for, and you're discovering it. And with a narrative film, you create it, and you need to create it. You don't have it. Like, whereas with a documentary, you're like waiting for that emotional moment. With a narrative, you're like, all right, now you guys get here and create like the most spectacular emotional moment ever, and you're just like. And you just hope that it happens, and it can, and it does, if you create, I think, the right environment to make it happen.
So, go ahead.
I was just going to ask Justin, what made you say yes when Jeremiah called to tell the story? It's somewhat autobiographical.
Yeah. It's somewhat autobiographical. So. The kind of hard facts of the book. I have two brothers. You know, my father's Puerto Rican, my mother's white. But it's fiction, and it's a fictional family. But I think that I had a few kind of offers from people who are interested in doing TV or film or something, some adaptation. And when I talked to Jeremiah, it wasn't like talking to anybody in the business or whatever, you know, it was just this really human conversation we had. And it was so clear that he was an artist. It was so clear that he had a vision. I went home and I watched In a Dream, and I just knew that it had to be him. I mean, he really, in that documentary, he really is able to talk about trouble in a family and love in a family and simultaneously, and it's a really complicated way. And it's just textural, and it's exactly what I wanted. And the end product is, I mean, it's more than I hoped for. It's more than I dared to hope for. It's a really beautiful film.
Speaking of family, I understand you really created that family atmosphere while you're filming. Can you tell us a little bit about that with casting and spending time together up in Utica? I think that's where you filmed.
Yeah. I just want to tag on to that, given that this is somewhat autobiographical for both of you. I mean, did you guys then co-cast? I mean, and it's like, well, that reminds me of my brother, or that reminds me of my brother.
We did, yeah. Yeah, Justin was in all the casting sessions and saw every single boy we saw, and every single ma and every single pops, and he would, you know, be very honest with his thoughts about them.
Not with the kids. The kids, it was hard. They're all so sweet.
He was like, they're all beautiful. I was like, this one's great, right?
Yeah. But what about getting everyone together? Yeah, and getting.
That was one of the things I told Justin. I was like, you know, I want to put them all together and make them live like a family. You know, the films I love, are the films of Mike Lee and the films of Ken Loach and the films, you know, of Lynn Ramsey, and these films where you feel like there's a very lived-in quality, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mike Lee, you know, workshops with his actors for a year and they all, you know, live together. And I wanted to create an environment where that was possible on a lower budget. So that was required of all of our actors, that they live together. And, you know, we did a couple like sleepovers with me as the director and the kids. And, you know, those were a bit of a disaster, but like they, you know, they ultimately, I think, led to a kind of bonding that, like, when you go through something and it's not just smooth, you come out the other side much stronger. And you feel that with this family. They keep coming out, you know, stronger and stronger and stronger.
Yeah. So the next category is always an interesting one. And I'm curious as to why you think Sundance put it into this program. And usually it's about kind of the next wave of filmmaking. I mean, is there something in it that's done differently or new wave? Or
Well, you know, my favorite films coming out of Sundance in the last, you know, 5 or so years have been in the next category, like Tangerine or A Ghost Story. Movies that, you know, play with narrative in a way that is unexpected. And the book is similar. You know, it's like the book is next too. It's like it's not like, you know, any other book you pick up off the counter. It's something like unique and special and outside the box. And, you know, I think you'll be surprised. And what we're finding with audiences is that, you know, how deeply emotionally experience is for them, where, you know, despite the fact that storytelling is not particularly linear, you know, it moves in a way that is really unexpected and uses devices that, you know, are not normal at all.
One of the things that really surprised me when I saw it was the use of animation. I think that is quite surprising and kind of avant-garde. And I hadn't seen it done like that before at all. It's really, the first time I saw it, I was like, whoa.
Yeah. I was just going to ask about that and your choice to use animation to tell the story. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We needed a way to get into Jonah's head. And in the book, there's a journal that Jonah's keeping, or that the main character's keeping in the book. He's nameless. I mean, can you talk about that a little bit, and I can explain how the...
Yeah, I mean, in the book, he doesn't have a name per se. Sometimes his name is We. It's written in the kind of first person plural. So when his name is We Wanted More, et cetera, and... It's when he belongs, part of the tribe, he's in the family. And then sometimes his name is I, and he kind of individuates. And that's what I wanted you to focus on in the book, and I wanted that to be the kind of entry point. So there's so much attached to a name, I think, especially when you're reading literature, there's so many associations. But we couldn't quite do that for the film.
And then we had to create a way to make the I present for the viewer that wasn't written. And so there's a one line in the very beginning of the book where he talks about crayons on the floor. And I was like, oh, well, why doesn't he have crayons, you know, all the time? And why isn't he drawing all the time? And, you know, my father's an artist, and he's like, you know, in a dream, my first film is about his obsessive imagination, in terms of his, you know, and it's expressed in his drawings, and I just thought I'll just do the same thing.
Okay, we need to wrap it up. We can buy the book. We can see the film a couple more times here in Park City, Thursday at 1 o'clock at Redstone, and then Saturday the 27th, 2:30 at the Egyptian Theater in Park City. And any plans for distribution at this point?
You know, we got a lot of bites. It's just like, you know, we're trying to negotiate the landscape. I they keep me out of it, to be honest. They're in their own world.
Okay.
They just tell me where it's good.
Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, Park City resident and KPCW fan. Our practice offers solutions for knee and shoulder problems to enjoy the active Park City lifestyle. More information is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Well, Westerners are notoriously independent, and when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that as far as political campaigning goes, money equals free speech, the citizens of Montana decided that campaign finance reform is a cause worth fighting for. Joining us now in the studio is director Kimberly Reed to talk more about her film, one of those in the U.S. documentary competition, Dark Money. Thanks for being with us, Kimberly.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Dark Money. I mean, is it kind of the companion, the follow-up to the film that we saw last year, I think it was, Citizens United?
You know, it's definitely related to the Citizens United decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, which came down in 2010. There have been many responses to the Citizens United decision. The one that I found the most interesting happened in my home state. And what happened there was, in many ways, Montana was kind of the canary in the coal mine for a lot of the conflict that happened around Citizens United. And Montana had a case, was actually the only state to resist Citizens United, claiming that there was a unique set of circumstances, mostly because of the history of corporate control of environmental issues, basically, that led to the largest Superfund site in the U.S. at the Berkeley Pit outside of Butte, Montana. And this kind of ever-present reminder of the environmental effects of corporate control of politics led a lot of Montanans to just say, no, we don't want to have corporate control of our politics, and resisted the decision in a way, the Citizens United decision, in a way that other states didn't. Montana actually led the charge, I think it was 22 states, resisting that. But unfortunately, that case was summarily reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court. I was filming already at the time on the ground in 2012 when that case was summarily reversed, and just decided that for the next couple of election cycles, I would need to follow these groups who were exploiting the Citizens United decision to funnel unlimited and anonymous money into the elections there.
Yeah. So it sounds like you've got many years into this, yeah?
Yeah, I got about 6 years. I started out thinking it was going to take about 6 months, and it's been 6 years. That's not uncommon in the documentary film world, though.
Right. As a native of Montana, what was that experience like for you?
Well, you know, I love Montana. It's a beautiful place to film. I like showing off how gorgeous it is there. But, you know, I think that it was really crucial for me as a Montana citizen to have the background that I think a lot of people there do. I grew up, you know, learning in grade school about the Copper Kings, who owned all the newspapers and owned all the mines and owned, you know, basically political control of the entire state, and seeing the effects of that, feeling the effects of that growing up there, I think gave me the same sensibility that other Montanans had, and which led to, you know, that being the one state that really fought back.
So who do you talk to in the film?
We have a wide range of elected officials who are Montanans, who are in the Montana's legislature, which is a citizen legislature. It's comprised of, you know, it only meets for 90 days every 2 years. So not a lot of time spent arguing about laws. And it's comprised of ranchers and, you know, just everyday folks who are, there's some lawyers, but it's not all lawyers. Like, I think you find in a lot of state houses. And that kind of citizen legislature becomes a really important part of the film. These are the characters that we're talking to. There's also a contrast with the national level. So we kind of look at Montana as being a microcosm for these campaign finance issues. So we focus on that. We focus on these kind of mostly moderate Republican legislators who are attacked by the far right wing of their own party with dark money. And those are many of the main characters. And we also contrast that at the federal level to enforcement officials, campaign finance cops, basically, at the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, and contrast what enforcement looks like at the federal level, where it's essentially busted, and enforcement on the state level, where they can actually make some gains.
So give us some examples then of how Montanans have then kind of fought back with this. I mean, it laws being passed that now they can't supersede the Supreme Court, but
they don't supersede the Supreme Court. Citizens United is the law of the land. But actually, what a lot of people don't realize is that in the Citizens United decision itself, by an 8-1 majority, they said that the only way that we can make this whole Citizens United decision work is if there's a lot of disclosure of the funding that goes into these campaigns. 8-1. Everybody says it's all dependent on disclosure. But when you look at the look at the laws state by state, you find very different levels of disclosure. So what happened in Montana is they passed, it was called the Disclose Act. That's an acronym, but that's what it did. It disclosed where political funding was coming from. And, you know, at the time, it was really leading the nation in the strength of the disclosure that it was requiring.
All right. You said just then Montana is one of only 22, so not even half?
That was the Montana was at the time leading 22 states, about half of the states, to resist Citizens United. But that was the case that got summarily reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2012.
What impact are you hoping the film will have?
You know, if you can pass some of the strongest campaign finance laws in Montana, which is, I think, in a lot of ways is not a place that most people would think of as this, you know, progressive bastion of campaign finance reform. You know, it's a pretty purplish, reddish state. But if you can call attention to these disclosure laws and do it in Montana, I think that you can do it in any state. I think there was a bit of a unique situation, but it's a really inspiring situation where people just got involved and they paid attention to the elections. They asked their elected officials to pay attention to these campaign finance issues. And they actually became an issue that people voted on instead of just kind of grumbling about or feeling like all politicians are corrupt, all politicians, you know, take all this money. They said, we're going to do something about it. And they, you know, they changed their laws. And if you can do it there through the citizen engagement, with the citizen legislature and really activated citizens who pay attention to these issues, and you can really make it happen. The other really important component of this is to have a watchdog press that's paying attention to these issues, writing about these issues, and the way that we convey that entire aspect of the film is really through the eyes of our main character, really, he's an investigative journalist, John Adams. He starts as a character who is just kind of digging into these campaign finance issues, following the money, the great tradition of investigative journalists. And he uncovers a lot, but he also runs into an important topic that our whole nation has been running into, which is the consolidation of the press, of newspapers, of major corporate newspapers. And he's actually caught up in that and has a lot of challenges to the way that he is actually able to write, to follow the money. He actually, like a lot of other of the people covering state house politics in Montana, kind of in one fell swoop in the space of a couple months, everybody was laid off. And so all of a sudden, we had a real crisis in Montana where nobody was following these state house politics. So in addition to having these really strong laws, in addition to having somebody who's actually enforcing these campaign finance laws, you got to have journalists who are writing about it and, you know, turning those into stories so that everyday citizens can understand where this money is going.
So any bites on the film at this point?
Yeah, we're talking to some folks, and we're interested in getting this film out and letting as many people as possible see it. You know, sometimes it becomes just all about the money, how much is selling for, but I really want to make sure that our film is seen by a bunch of people. I think that once you really see what happened with the canary in the coal mine, right? How Montana's responded. I think it's a very inspiring example for people who live in other states.
Okay. So does that mean theatrical or does that mean like television? Because I mean, the masses are on TV, yeah?
I think you'll see both. You'll see both. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, have some streaming. Yeah, that's the real challenge in putting together these deals right now is like who gets which window and who gets this and that. But, you know, the end goal is for us to have as many people as possible see this.
Yeah, after 6 years, it'd be gratifying, yeah.
Yeah, sure would.
Well, good luck with you. Hey, thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Kimberly Reed, again, the director of the the film Dark Money, one of those in the U.S. documentary competition here at Sundance. A couple more screenings. We've got one locally Thursday, 6:30 p.m. at the Ray, and then again Saturday at noon at the Park Avenue Theater. This is the Sundance Reel.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at utaholympiclegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host this morning, Linda Jaeger. Well, if you work for an organization where institutional bias is rampant, it's always easier to go along to get along. Director Stephen Mang brings us the story of police officers who put their necks on the line to expose illegal and unjust practices in his film, Crime and Punishment. Good morning, Stephen. Welcome to the Sundance Reel.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So give us a little bit of the backstory of the film. You found a group of whistleblower police officers who basically risk everything to expose racially discriminatory policing practices?
That's correct. Crime and Punishment follows the evolution of a group of minority whistleblowers who felt that they were unwilling to comply with the quota in New York City policing, and the film tracks their efforts to put a class action lawsuit together and then kind of radiates outwards to look at the collateral damage that the quota had been imposing on communities of color.
So how did you find out about this group? I mean, were they publicized? And
so, you know, this is actually not a news story. Some of our officers had been engaged in federal hearings, namely the 2013 Floyd versus New York City, which was looking at the overuse and discriminatory practices of stop and frisk in New York City policing. When around that time, my producing partner and I had been doing three other films about that issue, and we saw that when 2014 came around, what was supposed to be a new reform year with a new mayor and new PC, things had not changed, and in fact, they seemed to be boiling over with the death of Eric Garner, that there was a whole nother phase of this story that was unfolding that needed to be addressed. And the officers that were in our first three films were telling us that they were ready to come out and be transparent and have put their names out and be filmed more openly. And I was really fascinated by the prospects of doing a character-driven sort of observational film about these cops as they engaged more deeply in this kind of role of becoming whistleblowers. And so our access from the first three projects deepened at that moment, and we followed you know, very closely over the course of the next 4 years. And that's what became Crime and Punishment.
I was curious, I haven't seen the film yet, but just reading about it, you're, again, how you found and had that connection with Sandy Gonzalez and Manuel Gomez seemed to be so right in the story, and having that access and being able to have that information right in front of you must have been an interesting experience.
I mean, it was overwhelming because the trust we gained in those early years with those first several projects, you know, that really gave us entree into a constantly unfolding series of other stories that were compounding and further complicating what our conception of what was happening was initially. And so what wound up happening is, as I was filming more and more, the stories, one story would displace the next and the next and the next. And what we saw was this was actually a systemic view. And so of something that was in plain sight and has always been in plain sight, which is this idea of systemic structural criminal justice policy issues and problems. You know, some would call it systemic racism. You know, certain.
I was going to say that. So that's what this is all about. I mean, because if we've got the practice of quota-driven policing now unlawful, we still have officers continuing the practice. I mean, what are they getting out of it? It's just their bigotry coming out then. Is that what you're saying?
You know, something that's very difficult to pinpoint when we say systemic racism is who's at fault, right? And everybody wants to know who's at fault. Is the PC at fault? Is the department at fault? Are the officers at fault? And what we're trying to do in this film is show that there's no single person that we can hold accountable. Even the mayor or the commissioner in some ways could put forth the most well-intentioned statements and maybe under a certain other kind of pressure, because this is an economic revenue generating system that we live and abide by, and at the end of the day, this is about money, and it's about revenue generation in minority communities that is supporting the city's budget. And this is a situation we've seen in other cities like Ferguson and otherwise, and the film attempts to demonstrate that with all of the different stakeholders and victims and officers, attorneys, activists at work are interrogating different aspects of the problem, and we have to look at this more holistically.
Well, tell me how it's benefiting the economy, the city's economy. I mean, it costs money to put people in jail, or is it just you're just getting the fines paid? And I explain that.
Absolutely. You know, between the fines, administrative fines, arrests, fines, summonses, and tickets, the city receives over $900 million a year from this kind of activity that is generated very often on a street level police interaction. And, you know, we're in a point where all too often the response by law enforcement, not just in New York City, but across the nation, is to perceived disrespect is to arrest, summons, or employ use of force. And we need to see a cultural reboot of what the role of policing is and consider that those moments of police interaction with anybody, minority or otherwise, are a kind of horrible cyclical kind of impact where it leads to the deterioration of trust in police. And that deterioration of trust leads to a disrespect, which is then leading us back to point A.
Right, just a big circle.
Do you feel the subjects in the film think there's hope for changing the culture?
You know, they're both very driven, optimistic, and hopeful in a sense, but pragmatic about how hard it has been. You know, this is a story that's been unfolding for one of our characters has been subjects have been working on this for almost a decade, Adil Polanco, and you know I know he has felt very much alone in this. The news will come in, create a splashy story, and then the cruelty of the media cycles that it will be here today, gone tomorrow. Our hope is that with the film we can put this history on the map, not just a singular incident of a legal moment along the timeline of what's happening, or one singular case that is unfolding.
Yeah. So when in my introduction, when I say that these folks have risked everything, I mean, are we talking they're risking their jobs, or I mean, are their stake, are their lives really at stake because of their whistleblowing?
When officers are retaliated, it can come in many forms. Loss of overtime, which impacts their ability to support their families at a similar level. Shifts being changed to midnight hours, which would make for terrible childcare issues. But being split from your partner, being put on a dangerous post alone, and being denied medical care and the ability to go see a doctor when necessary. And which has to be approved because time has to be taken off. A couple of our subjects go through very serious medical conditions that need attention, and they are denied of.
But so there's unions, though, no, to protect them or not? I mean, especially the splitting the partner, that would be terrifying.
There's a big question about where the PBA has been on this, and what role they've played in leaving officers to languish under the pressure of quotas and the pressure of retaliation for not complying with the quota. Those two things are direct violations of 2010 state law. And so, you know, this is something that the officers, you know, are very cynical about. They don't believe that the PBA is out there to support themselves, these officers. You know, there needs to be a whole new conversation about what are we asking of police in society, and what role and position are we putting them into? Because on some level, when revenue generation is part of this formula, the system becomes a corrupting mechanism, and good cops with the best intentions who have joined the force to have a career, to change lives, to support their families, are asked and required and need to do certain things that they may not believe in. And you compound that by the scale of the city's department, the largest department in the nation, and you have big problems. You resist that and you're gonna be hurting. And so our film set out to try and show that. What was that invisible suffering that was happening? Not on just the street level, but also on the precinct level, because you know this is, and to be told by a voice that has been underheard in this national debate on police reform, which is officers who want to do good work, who love the job, who believe in the mission.
So, any bites from the film?
There's been a lot of excitement at the festival, and meeting the cops has been really positive. They're having a great time, finally having this first sort of sense of support in many years. And we've had some interesting talks, nothing finalized yet, but we're really hoping to find a strong home because, you know, we think this is a film people haven't really seen yet.
I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah. Again, you can see it Wednesday today, 2:30. It's playing at the Mark. Also Friday at noon at Park City Library, and a trip to the Sundance Resort on Saturday at noon. Hey, thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Stephen Mang, the director of the U.S. documentary competition film Crime and Punishment. It's the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campos Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CamposCoffee.com.
It's 9:49. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Sundance Reel, along with Linda Jager. Well, can you imagine what it must have been like to work at the National Lampoon in the early days? Director David Wayne and producers Peter Principato and Jonathan Stern can. They join us now in the studio to tell us about their new film, A Stupid and Futile Gesture, one of the premieres in this year's festival. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
In 2015, we laughed through the documentary Drunk, Stone, Brilliant, Dead, the story of the National Lampoon, your film, A Stupid and Futile Gesture, all in capital letters,
for
I think.
For those people who might be Googling it or looking for it on Netflix, it's actually A Futile and Stupid Gesture.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. A Futile and Stupid. Maybe that's why I had a hard time finding it. This is different because it's not a documentary. It's a dramatic feature.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, just based on your love of National Lampoon, I mean, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it goes pretty deep because the main subject of the movie is a character named Doug Kenny, a real-life guy whose name a lot of people might not know, but when you dig into his story, he was really one of the most central and pivotal figures in the creation of the entire comic sensibility that still exists today in the United States and around the world too. And his influence reaches so far, it's a spider web that goes everywhere. And so learning about his history and his fascinating rise is a great movie story.
And was based on a book, correct?
It's based on a book by Josh Karp, which then was found by our screenwriters, Colton and Abood, and then Peter here and John. And then we all got together and have been working on it for almost 10 years.
Wow. Gosh. So who plays Doug Kenny?
Will Forte plays Doug.
Uh-huh. And then you have a whole other cast of characters.
Yes.
I mean, with including the Saturday Night Live gang. And
right. Joel McHale plays Chevy Chase. And a lot of the familiar faces from around that 70s comedy scene are shown in the movie, as well as of a bunch of other amazing. It's a giant ensemble of comic and otherwise superstars that are gathered together in this thing.
Yeah, we have John Gemberling playing John Belushi and John Daly playing Bill Murray. We have...
Jackie Tone plays Gilda Radner. A pivotal point in that story and in our movie is when the National Lampoon, which was the corner of comedy at that point in print, suddenly was usurped by the beginning of Saturday Night Live. And that's and Saturday Night Live took a large portion of its writing and acting staff directly from the Lampoon.
Right,
but
right.
Another key part of the movie, though, is Doug Kenny's relationship with his Lampoon co-founder, Henry Beard, played by Donald Gleeson, who's an amazing Irish actor you've probably seen in 30 movies this year. Mm-hmm. And that's another really great element.
Tell us about the casting process. I mean, as you know, mentioned, it's a great ensemble, but it must have been interesting for like Will Forte to sort of come full circle being an SNL alum and then going back to...
Well, it's interesting. All of us in the movie have different relationships to the material in terms of influence or connection, like you said, with Will Forte, or in some cases like Martin Mull, who's one of the key characters. He was really around that scene at that time and knew a lot of these people. We also have people, we have characters that were famous for being in Animal House, playing small roles in the movie. And because Doug went on to make the movies Animal House and Caddyshack, so our movie shows how those movies came to be. But we brought in Allison Jones, who's one of the top casting directors early on in the process, and she helped us gather together this monumentally enormous, amazing ensemble.
And we weren't really looking for people who could do impersonations as much as people who truly embodied the spirit of the people that they were playing. You know?
And Allison Jones also has her own relationship to the people in this movie in that time period. This is someone who knew a lot of the people that she was now casting actors for.
So it's a comedy, right? I mean,
funny. We all like to refer to it as it's a drama about funny people. John was thinking of it as a comedy with dramatic elements, but we really found, you know, through David's eyes and David's hard work, the sort of tone of the film through the process of making it. You know, there's a tragic story by some accounts, you know, but it's also a story of a person who touched a culture, and then therefore the influence he held over that for the last 40 years. And it's also about this time when they were just really fearless in the comedy that they were trying, and the social satire and political satire that they were trying to put out there.
And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you guys were all fans then of the magazine itself. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
are you too young for that?
I was a little young for the magazine itself at the time, but I've since learned to really appreciate it. But it was the movies that came later that was my first entree, Animal House and Caddyshack.
When I first read the magazine, was reading the magazine, I didn't realize how far past its heyday it actually was. You know, I grew up on Mad Magazine, and then I got old enough to graduate to National Lampoon, and then 30 years later graduated to The New Yorker. But when I was reading the National Lampoon, all of these great people that were part of it in our movie were no longer there.
Right.
And I grew up reading both National Lampoon and Mad Magazine.
He's the coolest one.
And fell in love with it, especially the 1964 High School Yearbook, which we show in the movie. But it was really that influence of being that fan of the magazine and the things that came from that magazine, but still as an adult not knowing who Doug Kenny was, and until the writers brought me the book and said, do you know who he is? And then you read the book, my mind was blown, and I was embarrassed being so involved in the comedy world that I didn't know who this was. And it sort of started that process of not only feeling like we wanted to make the movie, but we had to make the movie because people should know who he was. And people should today be able to say, like, oh, all these roads maybe led back to him, and we owe him a little thanks.
So what's the reaction been from the screenings you've had? I mean, people laughing in the right spots?
Yeah, so far it's been amazing. We haven't had a public screening yet.
Oh, you haven't?
Tonight is the first one ever. It's the world premiere.
Tonight is the premiere.
But they will laugh in all the right spots.
That's a prediction.
But press reactions seem to have been very positive so far. And, you know, interviewers who have seen it have been kind of over the moon. And the thing that makes me very happy is it seems like the comedy nerds who do know Doug Kenny and care about this are liking it. And then... my hope is also general audiences who have no particular familiarity with any of it will still find it a really interesting story.
Yeah, like on the smallest level, the people we have shown it to, some have known him, some know the world, some didn't know him or the story at all, and all of them, you know, very, very luckily have enjoyed the movie.
But that's a challenge, which I think any movie about real historical figures or even really about the entertainment industry is to make it and to find the interesting part of these people's lives that's independent of your direct knowledge or of caring about the entertainment industry, which is itself kind of a subculture.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess you're kind of hoping for that cult status, right? I mean, that we saw with Caddyshack and Animal House. I mean, I guess how it just takes time to become that.
We would be so lucky if people liked it as much as Animal House.
I wouldn't call Animal House cult status. It was the highest grossing comedy of all time as soon as it was released. So it was probably the opposite of a cult, I would say.
Although Caddyshack, as our movie references, wasn't a success when it came out. And it's only after many years in hindsight that it's become what people perceive as a huge comedy success.
Yeah. It's gotten into the bloodstream.
I've had the parallel
another movie.
Experience. My film that came to Sundance in 2001 was Wet Hot American Summer, which was not picked up by a distributor and barely released many months later, and grossed, I think, $66,000 in theaters. But then since then has become considered one of the great comedy touchstones.
David, he's also being modest. It's a movie that a lot of people use as a litmus to decide if they're going to be friends or date the people who see the movie.
David, I remember actually walking with you somewhere, I think it was on Bleecker Street in Manhattan, when you said, oh, the movie finally turned a profit. And I that was 10 or 11 years after it came out.
Well, you're described as one of the great comedy directors. I mean, what establishes what? I mean, you're here and you're pretty somber.
Well, I think the slow burn is what made people think that, because, for example, that movie, Wet Hot American Summer, it seeped into people's consciousness over years and years. And I guess, like a fine wine, a lot of people saw that movie and a lot of things I've done once, and they were not sure what to think of it because maybe it was just different. And then the second time, they're like, oh, that's my favorite thing ever. And they just keep at it. This is my seventh time at Sundance, and just keep trying to keep making more stuff.
But I think David is considered one of the better and greater comedy directors because he...
Make no mistake, I'm incredible.
He has... He has an incredible point of view when it comes to comedy. He's got an incredible lens of which he sees the world through. His relationship with talent and the way he looks at material is just one of those unique situations that his work is always original. And so when you are a true comedy fan, you know, the fact that you work with somebody like that, you can appreciate, you know, what he does, and the artist that he works with also appreciates it. And he's an incredibly collaborative director, so all of those things put together make him somebody that I think people really look to as that type of person.
I'm blushing.
So we're seeing it's in the premiere category. Netflix is, am I correct that they have acquired it and then will distribute it in the theaters? And then
in fact, it will not go to theaters, but it will be on Netflix everywhere in the world on Friday.
Wow.
In 2 days.
We premiere tonight and we're live on Friday.
However, if you bring your computer into a movie theater, you can watch it in the theaters.
Oh. Well, pleasure to spend some time with you, and look forward to seeing it, whether it's again tonight, world
tonight
premiere,
at Eccles,
9:30, 8:30 in the morning tomorrow at the Mark, and then another local screening is at the Temple Theater Saturday night at 6.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Listening to Sundance Reel here on KPCW. Big thank you to our exclusive sponsor, Sandra Lee, presenting the documentary Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee. A big thank you to my co-host this morning, Linda Jager.
Thank you, Leslie. Always a pleasure to be here.
And that's a wrap. You're listening to Community Radio, listener-supported KPCW Park City. Stay tuned now. We've got music in store for you. A couple more days of the Sundance Reel, and it'll be a wrap.